It's just getting to grips with who really has power in the state.
Which are worse, quangos, you think?
HMRC aren't pretty particularly
is
good.
That a quango? It's a classic example of paying the Dane geld and the Dane comes straight back. But except the Vikings look like a bunch of girl guides compared to junior doctors. He thinks he's a little guy.
Yeah, with all of his dragons.
With all his masses of grants for his stupid apps.
Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by my co-host, Chris Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
Not very well, Tom, but I'll talk about that later.
And I know you want to unpack your trauma this afternoon, but before we do that, I want to introduce, returning to the show, John O'Connell, Chief Executive of the Taxpayers Alliance. How are you doing, John?
Not too bad, Tom. Tottenham's UEFA Cup win has really cheered me up.
Absolutely. Two-thirds of this podcast is fully coised, so we will avoid talking about that. But
if you want, it's of interest to
no one else but us.
Can we talk about the 17th place finish as well?
But before we get started, Chris, you wanted to air some grievances against the Elizabeth line or something?
Yeah, I would like to, please. We record this, folks, in Canary Wharf. And normally I get off Canary Wharf tube station. That is bad enough because sometimes, for reasons I do not understand, I come off a completely different direction to other times. That's confusing, but I can just about find my way around. This time I came from Farringdon on the Elizabeth line. Everyone goes on about how good the Elizabeth line is. I was almost excited. Remember Tom Harwood a few months ago said it was the most amazing
thing? Lyrical.
Someone told me beforehand that I would forgive Sadiq Khan everything when I'd been on the Elizabeth line. Right, firstly, it's just another tube. It's just another hole in the ground. It's a bit cleaner than the other lines because it's new. A
bit bigger.
In a few years' time, it's a little bit more Soviet, to be honest with you. I don't particularly like it. I know some people like Moscow subways and stuff. But I don't, well, not that I've ever seen them. Anyway, that's not the point. The Elizabeth line isn't particularly special, and let's not call it Elizabeth line, it's Crossrail, and we all know the reason they changed the name, because it was three or four times over budget. You've probably got the numbers, haven't you, John? It was a massive waste of taxpayers' money, and it's not that amazing. But that minor disappointment was nothing compared to when I got off the Elizabeth line at Canary Wharf Station. Any other country in the world would... Canary Wharf, when you go to Elizabeth line, Canary Wharf, that would be the same station as you get off on the Jubilee line. This one, I came out, I was like, I've no idea where I am. It's a bland hellscape at the best of times, Canary Wharf, but I had no idea what's going on. I had to ring you, didn't I? And you said, oh, it's quite some walk to the Spiked offices.
You were quite upset, I think that's fair.
I was absolutely, I still am, absolutely livid. Don't call it Canary, just call it something else.
What's even more infuriating, though, is that there's, what, three stations at Canary Wharf, the Elizabeth line, the Jubilee line, the DLR. None of them are directly connected. You always have to go up some stairs or across through some buildings or whatever.
But this one has just got the same name. I don't mind, if you're going to build a new tube station, build a new tube station, call it Canary Wharf Parkway or something like that. Don't give it the same name and expect... If you go even Clapham, right? Now, it's ridiculous that Clapham Junction, the busiest train station in the country, is not connected to London Underground. I don't understand why that is. It's ludicrous. But at least it has a different name to Clapham Common, which is the tube station in Clapham. They don't just call it Clapham and you end up at one and you might need to get a bus to the other one. I don't know. I mean,
about the fact you could get there from Farringdon quite easily, though?
That was quite good. It did stop for a while, actually, just outside Canary Wharf Station, which I thought was a flaw. I would rather have gone another way and use a Jubilee line. Complete waste of money, Elizabeth line.
It was originally... the poster boy for projects that were on time and on budget, and that's faded into the background the closer and closer it got, and the more money was wasted. Yeah,
John, have you got any travel-related grievances you want to air here before we go?
Many. Yeah, I was stuck outside Paddington again to try and get across to here, but the less said about that, the better. You know?
Well, thank you both for persevering.
Nobody's listening up. We've got rid of all but the hardest
core supporters. People who are still listening because they're fascinated by not just London transport talk, but Canary Wharf transport talk in particular. Let's move on.
Broad reach is sure.
This very loyal niche. So, John, let's talk about a big project that the Taxpayers Alliance have launched recently. It's called Quangos Uncovered. I keep wanting to call it Quangos Unchained, but that sounds too pro-Quangos, I suppose. But you at the TPA are very much anti-Quango, and you've been digging into all kinds of different stats and findings about just how bad our whole kind of quangocratic state is and how it functions. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you've been discovering?
Yeah, well, I suppose from our point of view, the quangos really are unchained. There's several hundred of them, depending on how you measure it. But we feel that the power of the state doesn't really lie with people who can be voted in and out of office. The large amounts of money are spent by quangos with very little accountability. And we wanted to dig into some of that and find out not only what they do, but who they are. So some of our first pieces of research on this particular topic have looked at who sits on the board of various quangos. And we've, you know, there were somewhere around 4,500 board positions at quangos. Lots and lots of them sit on multiple boards, and you wonder to what extent they have expertise across these different pieces. In fact, one chap even sits on 9 boards, so it picks up a pretty penny for doing so. We've also looked at how much, you know, in true TPA style, how much they're paid and their perks and their pensions. And again, you're looking at sort of somewhere around 1,500 senior civil servants on extraordinarily high salaries and the pensions that come with that. So it's really about digging into who makes decisions in UK politics. And you get that sense, right, when you go around the country, people say nothing ever changes. Mm-hmm. And why is that? Because, you know, you could have Labour there, you could have the Tories, Reform, if they win the next election, may find that they have exactly the same problem, that, you know, they try and do something, pull a lever, as they say in Westminster, and nothing happens. So why is that? And then what we want to do further into the project is really dig into the laws that have been in place that sprout these organizations, the regulations, statutory instruments that, you know, a classic bureaucrat will say, right, what we need, another quango. And Labour have started off talking about getting to grips with this problem. They scrapped NHS England. So that sounded good, appeared to be big news. But they've also, in the process of coming into office, announced the formation of 20 odd new quangos. So, you know, it's not just whack-a-mole, it's whack-a-mole for 20 more. So we're trying to dig into some of that. What we'd like to see happen, I suppose, it's putting power much more back into departments, departmental control. So, you know, if there's a minister in charge, he or she ought to be able to do what that particular government was elected to do, whether that is a red rosette, a blue rosette, mm-hmm. or a teal or turquoise rosette. What colour are
referred? Yeah, we worked out, because I see it referred to teal or turquoise, yeah, or light blue.
Whatever gorgeous colour that rosette will be.
Aquamarine.
Aquamarine. There we go. So let's have some aquamarine policies. It's just getting to grips with who really has power in the state.
Mm-hmm. Which are worse quangos, you think, John?
HMRC aren't pretty particularly
is
good.
Is that a quango?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, non-ministerial departments count as quangos in our book, for sure. Okay. They are... they're a state body separate from...
What's so bad about HMRC apart from the fact that it takes our tax money?
Well, I think what you tend to see with HMRC is the misalignment of treatment between individuals and small business and large business. You know, if you run a large business or you're involved in a multinational corporation, you can probably have meetings with HMRC where you talk about your tax treatment for the year. Whereas if you run a cafe or a hairdresser on a high street in Reading or wherever else in the country, one misstep and you get the red letter. You know, there isn't that sort of same treatment that you get.
What are the most ridiculous ones?
Of?
Quangos.
Most ridiculous ones are actually, funnily enough, ones that probably need to exist. So it would be the Advisory Council Committee on, you know... fungi or something like that, which would tend to be small groups of experts that get together a few times a year. You know, the only bill for them really is expenses and sandwiches. And even though they sound the silliest, they're probably the most important, because, you know, what government minister or necessarily permanent civil servant would know about these particularly niche issues? So you farm it out to some expertise. But it's the bigger problem. You look at Homes England. They don't get any... Homes built.
Natural in England as well.
Natural England. But
no,
Homes
no
England.
Fan of that one. What's
Homes England?
What's that do?
Well.
Why do they all end with England? Public Health England, NHS England.
Well,
Natural England.
It might denote what territorial space.
Well, yeah, it does. It does what it says in the tin in that perspective. But.
Well, maybe they've got the same PR branding agency or something. But they had the most staff in receipt of salaries over £100,000. And you match that up against delivery of homes in England, then you wouldn't.
What they do? What do they actually do? Though, I mean, all we need to build homes is to liberalise planning laws.
Well, quite. And then you start to wonder exactly why this body exists, why it's got so large. And then if you even look at NHS England, the one that got scrapped, when that originally was launched by Andrew Lansley back in 2012 with his NHS reforms, that was supposed to have a staff of a couple of hundred. It ended up with a staff of around 11,000. So as you know, at the IEA, it's that classic idea of mission creep, public choice theory, bureaucracy begets more bureaucracy. So, you know, they set something up with good intentions to be a small little advisory body to manage administration and stuff like that. And, you know, it burns.
Given the kind of catalogue of failure that you've uncovered, you know, something like 84% of the projects they're presiding over have become incredibly, you know, overrun, overexpensed, all the rest of it. Politicians of both left and right have constantly said at various points that they wanted to go to war with the Quangos, wanted to bonfire of the Quangos, as David Cameron talked about it. This Labour government have been trying to steal some of that rhetoric, and yet still they go back to this way of governing. What is it that attracts them so much about it? Is the fact that it's arm's length and unaccountable and they can distance themselves?
Yeah, originally the theory was that politicians could devolve out the responsibility, and therefore if something goes wrong, it's not their fault, it's the fault of someone else. But what they've learned over the years is actually when something does go wrong, it's not the Quangocrat that's dragged in front of Nick Robinson on the Today programme, it's the minister. Mm-hmm. So they devolve out the responsibility and then get shouted at when it all goes wrong. Yep. So it's double bubble for them, really. But yeah, you were mentioning the 84%. That was our work on Quangos that have delivered capital projects late. So going back to our friend Chris on the Elizabeth line, you know, the delivery on major projects, be it sort of very obvious physical infrastructure or things like IT, is scandalously over budget and almost always late. I mean, if that's true in the private sector, probably, but at least there's sharper incentives in the private sector where there isn't quite so much in the public sector. And you definitely get a sense that if you fail at a project in the public sector, nothing much happens to you. In fact, you probably get promoted elsewhere.
And the number of people, as you say, who hold these kind of multiple positions, I think it's the guy who's in charge of GB Energy, which no one can work out what it actually is because it's not an energy company per se. He is also in charge. So this is Jürgen Meyer, he's the chair of Great British Energy. He's also the chair of Innovate UK's Digital Catapult, vice chair of the Northern Powerhouse Partnership, and is also leading an expert review of UK rail and transport infrastructure. So I'm amazed this kind of philosopher king.
It really is.
Understands so much of these.
Jack of all trades, isn't he?
Absolutely. There seems to be a lot of cases.
Polymath. It must be.
And I know, and this is a separate piece of research you've been doing, but the NHS, when we're talking about people, you know, administrators and so on, taking quite large salaries, that's also something else you've been looking at recently. So it seems like the picture there is, as ever, quite shocking.
Yeah, and you know, we had a piece of work that was on the front page of the Daily Mail yesterday where we looked at senior managers in the NHS, so non-medical staff for the most part. And what we're really trying to do there is, you know, despite the work that we did with the Daily Mail, is actually there are some good performers in there as well. And who are they? And can you benchmark against the good performers and the bad performers? I think with waiting lists where they are, with people waiting for treatments and operations and all the rest of it, to read that people continue to get massive pay rises in those senior roles is probably somewhat galling. But it's, you know, as it were in the public sector, you know, we've seen time and time again that pay only goes in one direction. Still obviously very union influenced when it comes to pay negotiations. Pay can often be set from independent pay bodies, so they can sort of say, nothing to do with me, you know, I was just given this. So yeah, we're really just trying to shine a light on bad performance, but also good performance, and show where, you know, trusts can learn from one another, NHS trusts can learn from one another to deliver better outcomes for patients. Mm-hmm.
And Chris, when we're talking about the NHS, most people often make a distinction. You know, they don't mind the frontline staff being well remunerated, people like nurses, people like doctors and so on. Mm-hmm. But I know you're unique insofar as you even think some of the frontline staff are, you know,
well,
on the take.
Doctors specifically.
So is there anything that's happened recently? The fact that they're balloting for strike action?
They're balloting for strike action, having been given a 20% pay rise in the last 2 years, been offered 5.4% pay rise at a time when inflation is about 3%. And they're going to go on strike again. Their starting salary for junior doctors, except you can't call them junior doctors anymore, because part of their negotiation is that they get to be called resident doctors. I don't know why. Doctors in training is a much better name for them. which used to be an official name. Call them doctors in training because they're not fully trained. They don't know what they're doing. They've just been to university. They haven't actually treated anyone properly. Maybe a few experiments, you know, while they're going through training. They don't know what they're doing. They're a liability and they're on 38 grand straight out of university now. And they want another 20%. And they honestly think they're worth it. Anyone who's familiar with my work knows that I basically hate doctors.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them. But anyone who's involved with the British Medical Association is scum. We should replace them all with physician associates who are lovely people and give you a better service.
That's a Snowden deep cut, that the physician associates thing. But the arguments around real terms pay cuts over time,
it's all a lie as well.
You know, they inflate it.
To 2008.
They do inflate it.
Yeah, supposedly. They say...
That's real, though, surely.
We want to go... No, it's not real. We want to go back to 2008. I haven't seen any analysis that backs up their claim that whatever insane pay rise they want to be on, which I guess is like, if they're on 38 now and they want another 20%, they want to be on about 46 or something, £1,000 a year, out of university. So the level one is 46 grand. So, and we all know that's going to go up to 100, 150, plus an insane pension by the end of it. And they're not going to have any time to spend it because they work so hard. You know, we're doing 12-hour days. So why do they need all this?
Why do they need all this money? Yeah.
Ridiculous. So
I guess how much of this is informed by their particular place on the pecking order and how much they've been paid.
Well, they are,
and how much this is just sheer prejudice on your part towards this.
No, this is just sheer avarice and greed by the most venal people in the world who are starting off basically at the bottom of the pile, in my opinion, below nurses, certainly below physician associates. And below the toilet cleaners in the NHS, as far as I'm concerned. And they don't deserve a penny more. In fact, we should never have given... West Streeting should never have given it. It's a classic example of paying the Dane geld and the Dane comes straight back. But except the Vikings look like a bunch of girl guides compared to junior doctors. And their claim that they just want pay restoration... Mm-hmm. Back to 2008, as far as I can tell, is nonsense. It's based on using the RPI rather than the CPI.
Yeah.
Everyone knows that
that's inflated. RPI is nonsense. Cancel out what they've been claiming, does it?
Yeah, I know it does, because the RPI is much... Well, it's a measure of inflation. I mean, it's an inflated measure of inflation. Yeah. They use it for student loans and they use it for train fares because they can whack it up more. And they shouldn't do. They should get rid of RPI completely. But, you know, everyone... who knows anything about, you know, economics knows that RPI is just a fraudulent measure. And I don't really care what they were paid in 2008 anyway. Maybe they were overpaid in 2008. Have they ever thought about this?
These
scumbag doctors. Maybe we were massively overpaid and we should get them down to a normal level.
Well, I was listening to this on the radio earlier and I was sort of thinking to myself, well, the BMA are talking about, well, if we don't get this pay restoration, then our doctors will leave the country.
Oh, yeah, we're going to go to Australia, aren't they? Yeah. We're all going to go to Australia.
I was thinking they must be against wealth taxes then, presumably.
Why is that?
Well, you know, if you put wealth taxes in, people leave the country and then...
Oh, I see. No, that's only for other people.
Oh, it's for the other people.
No, it's only other people who respond to incentives like that. They can all go to Australia. Go on, let's see how much demand there is for a bunch of whining poms in Australia. Go down there, get lonely. You have to keep... All the extra money you get, you'll be spending on flights to come and see your family at Christmas. You won't actually make any more money. You'll just be lonely and surrounded by Australians. So go on, off you go. Stop threatening it. Just go to Australia. We'll manage ourselves. And in fact, while we're at it, let's just have back the £200 billion we spend on the NHS. Give it back. Let's have, what is it, 16 grand for a family of four. That's how much we spend on the NHS. Give us our money back. We'll go off and take our chances. And legalise opium so we can get in boots if we've got any aches and pains. We don't really need... We don't need doctors.
We just need a
bottle of whiskey and a saw.
We've got to the grits of this. You're just sceptical the whole necessity of doctors to stop.
Okay. Well, we can't afford medicine, so let's just take our chances.
Saw. There we go. That's a nice, clear policy proposal.
That's how West Streeting should be negotiating, right? That might only be a starting position, but that's how you should go in strong like that. Just like Stonewall, go, we don't need doctors. We don't need a health service. Now, come at me. Are you going to change? How about 4%?
Where's Streeting, if you're listening?
That's how you negotiate. And also, Keir Starmer, that's how you negotiate. Keir Starmer is to negotiation while Julian Morn is to litigation. paying people to take away sovereign territory. And the EU deal, as far as I could tell, was just completely one-sided slap in the face. Can no one negotiate anymore?
There we go. Yeah.
Get me involved. I'll do it for now.
With free drugs and power tools, yeah.
With what?
With free drugs and power tools, opium and swords.
A kind of barber surgeon. No, I'm not.
Well, I'll do that as well. Yeah, I'll volunteer for the surgery too. But let me do the negotiation first.
Yeah, sure.
If the negotiation doesn't work, I will do a bit of moonlighting with the surgery.
But I suspect that you're telling doctors to sod off to Australia actually isn't a negotiating position for you. You just actually want them to go.
That's the best kind of negotiating position. when you actually mean it and they know you mean it.
Exactly. It is not a bluff.
Negotiating from a position of strength.
Sure.
Well, while we're talking about public health, Chris, should we look at some of the nanny state or at least nanny state adjacent stories that you've picked out? One of which is our old friend, I was going to call him Phil Spector then.
Tim Spector.
Tim Spector, thank you very much. He's a very different man in many different respects. But he...
nicer man.
Exactly. His wellness brand... Zoe has got in trouble with the Advertising Standards Authority for misleading people. This was presented as a kind of health food supplement. You sprinkle it on your food. It's called Zoe 30 Plus or something to that effect. And it's now been pulled up by the ASA for being misleading on the grounds that it contains ultra-processed
food. Oh, sweet irony.
I was going to say, so what side are you on in this situation? It's a
well, I need to be very careful what I say about Tim Spector. So I will be. And just give you the basic facts about the man. Well, not the man, but this particular story. Tim Spector, in case people don't know who he is, he's written endless books about health and dieting in particular. And the gist of all of them is like everything you thought you knew about food is wrong. And indeed, everything I said in my previous book last year is wrong. You need to buy this book. And he, like a lot of these people, he jumped on the ultra-processed food bandwagon. I think he was on the gut microbiome before then. And prior to that, he was on the anti-sugar thing. And, you know, it's like fashion, really. He goes in and out every season. But
people remember him from COVID as well for the Zoe app.
Oh, my word. You know, I'd actually almost forgotten about that. Yeah. So he had the...
symptom tracker app.
The Zoe sneeze tracker, as I called it, because it wasn't doing anything other than just telling when if you coughed and sneezed, you put it in and he would just assume it was COVID or something. And so he got these incredibly inflated figures of how many people had COVID long after everyone had been vaccinated, and it was like the middle of summer and actually everything was fine. But it gave people like Diet Sage something to cling to. And every now and again, he'd retrospectively change his graph so it fitted more closely with the Office for National Statistics. I've forgotten all this stuff. Wonderful days, weren't they? Anyway, he's one of the things he's doing to make a bit of cash is, aside from the weird things that people have stamped on their... on their arm, which and pay £30 for the privilege to have some fairly basic measurements taken, is he's selling some kind of supplement. And it is involving, he's got into bed, figuratively speaking, with Stephen Bartlett, another man I won't say very much about. And they were advertising this thing as not having any ultra-processed food. And as you say, Tom, it turned out that it was ultra-processed. And the ASA gave quite an entertaining judgment on it because he was really hoist by his own petard, Spector, because his defence was, oh, there isn't really a proper definition of ultra-processed food, which is true. But insofar as there is, he was making an ultra-processed food. And he said, well, this is only like a... I don't even know what it was. It was like a shot or something.
What was the supplement?
It was something you would sprinkle on top of your food to make it more nutritious.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Right, to make it what?
More nutritious somehow. I'm not sure.
That sounds a bit iffy straight away, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But again, I won't say anything about that.
If anything's ultra-processed, surely it's, something where it's just some sort of...
Yeah, well, one of the most... The most common definition of ultra-processed food, as given by people like Chris Van Tulleken, is if it contains stuff that you don't have in your kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And this stuff contained things that certainly I don't have in my kitchen.
It contained things I can't even pronounce. I forget what they are.
Yeah. A couple of exotic ingredients. Mm-hmm.
But didn't Van Tulleken say in his book, the second edition of his book, that xanthan gum, if you have it in your kitchen and make a recipe with love... then it doesn't count as ultra-processed.
Yes, he did.
Love, so it was everything.
Well remembered.
That's the...
yeah.
Chicory root, inulin, and nutritional yeast.
Yeah, well, we've all got that in our kitchen.
Absolutely.
Next to the salt and pepper. Yeah. So, yeah, hoist braised and petard. Ha-ha.
Yeah. It is, it is also kind of incredible that on the basis, it was just one complaint from a nutritionist. And then but that's how the ASA roll really, doesn't it? One person gets upset.
That's all it needs. Good.
And then what's the recourse?
Well, they can challenge it, but I don't know how they could.
Yeah. Well.
But,
it's an open and shut case.
No, absolutely.
He's going to have to redraw his claim.
All right. Okay.
We shall see. Chris, you want to tell us?
He wrote a bitter article for The Telegraph about it.
He did.
Saying it's not fair that this concept we cranks have invented was supposed to go after big food companies.
No, exactly.
But it's going after the little guy. He thinks he's a little guy.
Yeah, with all of his Dragons Den.
Yeah, with all his masses of grants for his stupid apps and all these £30 a month idiots paying all.
Although, if he's now sort of in a fight against the big state, if he's calling the big state,
you think he could be a potential ally?
Yeah, he's turning against the UPF crusade. He said the debate around it lacked nuance and it becomes scaremongering.
Oh, I think I've been saying that, haven't I? Oh, I got called a food industry stooge when I said it.
Phil/Tim, if you're listening, please get in touch.
Yeah, come on the show, Tim.
Yeah, and
they're all big fans.
Should we also talk very briefly, Chris, about the government have essentially shelved or paused their introduction of the junk food advertising ban
on less healthy food,
and it's upset one of your old kind of bete noirs. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this?
Greg Fell, who is not only the public health director for Sheffield but also the head of the Association of Public Health Directors. Again, I'm not going to say exactly what I think of Greg on a public forum like this, but he was not happy about this postponement.
Mm-hmm.
There's yet another postponement. It's just been postponed since Boris Johnson's day. And it's been postponed because people look at it, politicians and experts look at it and go, well, this is really quite extreme. No other country is doing this. And it's not great for competition in the market, you know? So it keeps getting pushed back. And this time, apparently, it's only been pushed back because the legislation was so badly written in the first place that it means that... I think the gist seems to be that you can't advertise your brand if your brand is associated with a less healthy food.
Mm-hmm.
So even if McDonald's does what these people want it to do, which is reformulate, for example, its quarter pounders, so it's no longer less healthy, they still won't be allowed to advertise it. And they won't even allowed to just advertise this as a logo. I think that's the idea. Badly written legislation, written in haste to please a bunch of fanatics who don't really care or know anything about business. And so it's only been postponed by 3 months. Greg Fell and the Association of Public Health Directors put out a very indignant response, usual thing, tobacco playbook, actually like the tobacco industry, people are dying because of this, advertising ban's not coming. Just kind of pathetic stuff, really. Turns out, in fact, the advertising industry and the food industry are actually going to comply with this voluntarily from October when it was supposed to come in. They just want to get the legislation fixed
They always just roll over, don't they?
Well, supposedly they're following the tobacco playbook. Mm. Did that involve rolling over? I think probably it did do to some extent. Any thoughts on this, John? Putting you on the spot.
This is just like Chris settling various scores. So how much you can contribute to that?
I'm a big fan of Snowden's work, so I'm happy to help him settle scores where necessary. But it's exhausting. You know, when is the ban coming in? Who are they going to comply voluntarily? Why are they even delaying it anyway?
Because they need to change the legislation to allow companies like McDonald's to just advertise anything.
Gotcha, right. Mm-hmm.
Sorry to put you on the spot there, John. I can see you don't care a great deal.
I mean, I care. I care to a great deal. I've got a little more to add than your expertise on this issue, to be honest.
One day I'll tell...
You could be my quango.
One day I'll say exactly what I think about all these people.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
When they're all dead.
Can I come on that show as well?
Yeah.
If you're still alive.
A long score set. We should do one just for the supporters or whatever, kind of Chatham House rules, Chris.
That's a good idea.
There we go.
Make a fortune. Get a Patreon.
Exactly. What a niche that would be. If you're really into Chris having a go at various different forms of London transport and settling scores with public health bods you've never heard of, that's the...
In the much more aggressive way than
exactly.
It currently
yeah,
does.
Yeah, exactly. More effort.
It's not slander if you do it to a pay-per-view audience.
Well, I'm looking forward to testing that theory in court. John, before we let you go, as you've been on the show before, you know we always ask our guests, because we're very libertarian, anti-ban podcast. If you had to have one ban, what would it be? The only rule being that it can't be worthy. I remember last time you were on the show, you had a great one, which was people shortening things like coleslaw to slaw on menus, which is genuinely annoying.
The Menu Regulations Act, 2024, I believe.
You are a dictator.
They always end up being travel related, but this one is travel related again. I'm sorry, but I was on a train earlier, and it was it's this sort of personification of horrible inanimate objects like bins and, like, you know, please put your rubbish in me and stuff like that. Like, you know, don't put your, like, you know, trying to make jokes. Don't put your jumpers down, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Don't put your ex's jumper down here or your...
Information only, no humour, no personification. The Signage Act 2025.
Virgin Trains were the worst for them.
Terrible, right? Yeah, they were.
I mean, they've been closed down now.
Yeah.
But every single time you went to the toilet, I think when you opened the lid,
they even played an audio.
Yeah, it played some.
Yeah.
That little stupid twee message that was supposed to be funny.
Yeah.
Every single time.
So the Signage Act 2025. Mm-hmm. I'd be seeking support in both chambers. Yeah.
Another great
one, John.
Yeah.
Chris, John, thank you very much.
Cheers. Thank you very much. Get your disposable vapes in quick. God save the king.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of Last Orders. If you're watching this on YouTube, make sure you subscribe and click the bell so that you never miss another Spiked video. If you're listening to this on your podcast app, make sure you subscribe there and leave us a glowing 5-star review. And if you'd like to get in touch with your questions or band suggestions, email us at lastorders@spiked-online.com.